This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today we continue our Election 2020 series with two looks back, one way back and the other more recent, to derive important lessons for this election season. First, we talk with John Nichols about his new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, the enduring legacy of Henry Wallace's anti-fascist, anti-racist politics. Then Bernie Sanders campaign strategist Chuck Rocha talks about his new book, Tio Bernie, the inside story of how Bernie Sanders brought Latinos into the political revolution. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. The Democratic Party is really two parties. There's its largely progressive base with a small but growing representation, and then there's its centrist to center-right corporate-dominated leadership. Many think this split began with Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council. But according to my guest, John Nichols, it actually goes back much further, all the way to the 1944 Democratic Convention, when Henry Wallace was defeated as the choice for FDR's VP. Wallace warned of an American fascism rooted in corporate domination and racial and gender oppression. No surprise, the wealthy and the racists in the party hated him for it. In his book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, Nichols takes us from FDR and down to our times to describe the party's split between its left and right wings and gives us the urgent lessons that history has for us today. Well, John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a great honor to be with you. I love what you do with the show.
Oh, thank you. The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party was a book of many surprises, a deep dive into a history that I knew only the vaguest outlines of, and it is such a really an important and a book about a very prescient person and a book very relevant to us today. It really focuses, as you say, the lost soul of the Democratic Party was a man, and his name was Henry Wallace. Tell us who Henry Wallace was.
Well, Henry Wallace was a remarkable figure. He was a farmer, first and foremost, born in Orient Township in Iowa in the late 1880s on a family farm, which the house still stands. And he was a member of a family that was very, very involved in Midwest agricultural organizing and journalism in the early part of the 20th century. So he came up the son of the editor of what was called Wallace's Farmer. And that was a newspaper that was very, very popular across the Midwest with farm families. And it combined practical advice with a lot of politics. Now, Wallace was a progressive Republican. And in those days, in the early 20th century, there was a lot of progressive Republicans. Wallace was in the Robert M. La Follette camp, which was, you know, pretty militant on a lot of issues and pretty pro-labor, pro-small farmer, very concerned about monopolies, very concerned about big business. And when Franklin Roosevelt was running for president in 1932, he reached out to Wallace and basically asked Wallace if Wallace would kind of cross the partisan divide and support the Democratic candidacy of that year. Wallace agreed to do so because he was so concerned about the Great Depression and because he liked Roosevelt. And quite remarkably, when Roosevelt became president, he appointed or named Wallace to be Secretary of Agriculture. Wallace served 8 years as Secretary of Agriculture and was really one of the dynamic figures of the New Deal. In fact, in many ways, the truest believer in the New Deal and implemented many of the programs. Then in 1940, when Roosevelt wanted to turn left, he asked Wallace to join him on the ticket as vice president. That meant they pushed aside the much more conservative vice president at the time, John Nance Garner. And this was a real move to the left by Roosevelt and the Democratic Party. It was controversial because Wallace was controversial. He was somebody who was very, very outspoken. and frankly, not a traditional politician in any sense. But he joined the ticket, was a very effective campaigner in 1940, extremely popular with trade unions, with small farmers, and with minority communities, particularly with the African-American community, which he had for many years advocated for civil rights and for a much more progressive stance than most of the Democratic Party. They won in 1940, and Wallace became a central figure in the administration's response to World War II, and also, frankly, in maintaining a lot of the New Deal sensibilities within the administration. But that brought him into deep conflict with the right-wingers, the segregationists, the Wall Streeters within the party. And so in 1944, he was forced off the ticket. And ultimately, that's the sort of the great pivot point at which my book begins.
Right. Let's revisit some of those different things. First of all, you said in 1940, FDR decided to turn left. Wasn't he left before then? Wasn't the New Deal happening earlier than 1940?
Yes, it was. There's no question of that. But remember that the New Deal was a huge operation that was very complex in many ways. And it relied on a coalition that included radical socialists and Wall Streeters, that included civil rights campaigners and racists. It was a huge coalition because of the Great Depression, because of the challenges of the moment. And Roosevelt compromised on many, many issues. While the New Deal was progressive in many ways, and while it used government very effectively to respond to an economic crisis, it didn't address racism at the level that it should. It didn't address a host of core economic issues at the way that it should. And frankly, there was always a frustration. There was a left in America in the 1930s that was very, very critical of Roosevelt for not going far enough. And it was a very substantial left. You had the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota, the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, the Progressive Party in Wisconsin. All these parties literally elected governors and senators. And then you had the American Labor Party in New York and LaGuardia and others who were often pushing to the left of where Roosevelt was at. So the bottom line was that Roosevelt was obviously concerned about, you know, battling the far right, but he was also concerned about reaching out to the left, to a much more left-wing voting bloc, to build out the coalition in that direction. And Wallace was very critical to that.
So say more about Wallace's relationship with FDR and how he influenced him in a leftward direction.
Yeah, Wallace and FDR really liked each other. There's simply no question of that. And doing the book, I spent a lot of time reading the diaries, the letters, the records of their relationship. And there was simply no question that while they were not that far apart in age, Roosevelt had an almost paternal attitude as regards Wallace. He really liked him as a protege, almost a member of the family. And when Wallace was controversial, and he was often very controversial, Roosevelt was amused by it and intrigued and welcomed it. They would joke with each other a lot. And it was, I guess the best way to understand it is that Roosevelt, I think, saw Henry Wallace as someone who pulled not just the administration and not just our politics, but Roosevelt himself in a more idealistic and more progressive direction. And so they worked together very, very well. Unfortunately, while Roosevelt liked Wallace, many of the people around Roosevelt despised Wallace. They saw him as far too radical. They saw him as pushing too hard, trying to do too much. And so there were always great rivalries and great battles. And at a certain point in 1943, within the White House, the rivalries became so intense that Roosevelt did dial down some of Wallace's responsibilities. If you read the diaries, if you read the letters and the other communications, it wasn't out of a dislike for Wallace. It was more out of a fear that there might be divisions in the administration so great that it might undermine all of the things they were trying to do, particularly the war effort. And so Roosevelt didn't always let Wallace do everything Wallace wanted to do or encourage Wallace to do everything he wanted to do. But still, at the end of the day, if you look at the whole of their relationship, it was a close relationship and a good one. And frankly, it's fascinating that it may have been closest at the very end of Roosevelt's life, when Wallace had been forced out as vice president, but returned to the administration as Secretary of Commerce. And Roosevelt and Wallace were planning for a post-World War II renewal of the New Deal, something that unfortunately never really happened because Roosevelt died in April of 1945.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with John Nichols about his new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. And one of those rivals or people who hated Henry Wallace was a former Commerce Secretary, right, Henry Luce. Talk about Henry Luce's notion of an American century versus Henry Wallace's counterproposal of the century of the common man and the import of this, because they are two really diametrically opposed ideas.
They really are, and there's simply no question that Luce and Wallace were two sides of a coin at a critical point during World War II. Now, it's important to understand that both of them were people who were, they were both anti-fascist. They both wanted to defeat the Nazis, but it was a question of the vision of what would come after that defeat, or really what you were fighting for. And Luce, who was not really a political figure, Luce was actually a publisher, and he was very powerful with Time and Life magazines. And his argument on an American century was that basically, if the United States prevailed with the Allied forces in World War II, that the U.S. should basically put its imprint on the world, that it should define the post-war era in a very U.S.-centric way, in a way that kind of obsessed with advancing U.S. interests and basically taking advantage of the rest of the world, just a sense that the U.S. would be absolutely dominant in the post-war era. Wallace had a radically different vision. Wallace believed that the post-war era needed to see a number of initiatives internationally, as well as domestically, that would seek to avoid the wars of the future. He did not believe, as a man of science, and Wallace was very much a scientist, he did not believe that the world would survive another world war. It was his view that with the rise of atomic weapons, and he was very much conscious of this, as well as just the sort of warfare that you saw in the Second World War, that another war would destroy the world. And also, frankly, that a failure to address the fundamental challenges in the world, which he did see as colonialism, imperialism, exploitation, the impoverishment of the majority of people on the planet, if you didn't address those things, that you would have continued horrible instability. And so he proposed a century of the common man, or I would add the common woman. And what he suggested was that the United States would, of course, be a strong force in the post-war era, but its work should be on behalf of creating an equitable world in which colonialism, imperialism was addressed and ended, and that you really could have the rise of democracy and the rise of fair and humane relations between countries. And so it was a very different vision. And really, at the heart of it was an idea of where you would put the power of the United States. Would you put it in the service of Wall Street and large corporations, the monopolies that Wallace hated? Or would you put it in the service of working class people in the U.S. and abroad with the idea of advancing their circumstance and making their lives better?
Yeah, in fact, he had a very expanded and deeper vision of democracy that encompassed, he said, economic, ethnic, educational, and democracy in the treatment of the sexes.
Yeah, he was very, very committed to, in fact, Wallace was very committed to an equal rights amendment to the Constitution, to the protection of women in the workplace and in business. And also, he had a really strong vision for the post-war era, in which he argued that the women who had gone into the factories, the Rosie the Riveters, if you will, needed to be given opportunities in the post-war era, not just simply, you know, say, given a thank you and sent back to their pre-war circumstance. And so he was quite visionary in this regard, very, very close to Eleanor Roosevelt, very, very close to Frances Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, and others who I think shared this vision.
So what is the connection between this vision of the century of the common man and FDR's Economic Bill of Rights and the Four Freedoms and the people's peace? Maybe the last one is Wallace more than FDR.
Well, these things are all intersecting, and you're very wise to reference them, because there is simply no question, and this is one of the great conclusions that I came to in researching the book, and I think maybe what the book contributes, particularly from a historical standpoint, is an understanding that Roosevelt and Wallace thought immensely during World War II about the post-war era, what it would mean, what it would be, and how you would make the changes that are necessary to assure that we, as a country, and frankly, as a world, didn't fall back into the dangerous zone that is, I think, historically was referred to as so-called normalcy, i.e. you went back to what existed before, and everybody was very comfortable, except that all of the old injustices, all of the old inequities were still there. And so with the Four Freedoms, Roosevelt, you know, really defined a vision for why you were fighting for war, what you were fighting for internationally. And then with the Economic Bill of Rights, Roosevelt spoke specifically about the United States and the changes that would be made in the post-war era to really address economic and frankly, social inequality. And the Economic Bill of Rights simply said that this country had to, yes, maintain political rights, freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, to petition for the redress of grievances, but it also had to have economic rights, because if people didn't have housing and healthcare and education and access to work, you know, the basics of life and guarantees where these things might not be available, then you ended up in a situation where we were always sort of threatened, our freedoms were undermined by economic necessity and economic fear. And the Depression had shown us, you know, just how dangerous and how destructive that could be. And so they talked about this. And yes, they spoke of a people's peace. Now, you're right that Wallace was the great advocate for the idea of a people's peace. And what he was talking about was simply a notion that after all that Americans had gone through to fight World War II and to prevail in that battle, that, you know, they were owed not a return to what was before, but a future that really did share the wealth in humane and equitable ways, and that had growth, yes, because there were people who were going to need jobs, and Wallace spoke of creating tens of millions of jobs, but also that assured that growth didn't simply enrich Wall Street, didn't simply enrich corporate, you know, barons, but that in fact shared the wealth and extended it to the great mass of Americans.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Nichols about his terrific new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Now, Henry Wallace was famous for making this speech, the Common Man speech, in which he took up, if I'm not mistaken, he took up the idea of an American fascism that was different than the fascism that the U.S. was fighting in Europe, the Nazi in, you know, against Germany and Italy. Yeah, I have to quote this amazing quote that you make in the book of Wallace's, because it's so prescient to today. "The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With a fascist, the problem is never how to best present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or more power. So talk about that, and talk about who was he talking about? Who were the American fascists he was so worried about?
He was talking about a lot of folks, and maybe I should back up a little bit and just give a tiny bit of context for his essay on the danger of American fascism. And that is simply to say that in 1943, there were race riots in a number of American cities. And in Detroit, especially, it was incredibly violent and incredibly deadly. A number of African Americans were killed, many of them by police officers. And Wallace went to Detroit and did something quite remarkable. He spoke to a huge crowd, an integrated crowd, mostly of trade unionists. And he said, look, and I'm paraphrasing here, look, I got to tell you, we're over in Europe fighting against fascism and fighting against people who divide folks based on their race or religion or ethnicity. And people here in the United States need to understand that if you're engaging in racism, if you're, you know, saying that you won't treat people in the same way because of the color of their skin or their ethnicity, then you are practicing an Americanized fascism. And so he very bluntly identified racism as an Americanized fascism, sexism as an Americanized fascism, and frankly, segregation, which was still very much a part of the American reality at that time. We had an apartheid system operating in the American South, and frankly, an immense amount of segregation and discrimination throughout the whole of the country. He bluntly said, you know, this is fundamentally wrong. This is the sort of thing we're fighting against. Well, that caused an immense controversy. The New York Times criticized him for dividing the war effort with such statements. And certainly the Southern segregationists hated him even more for saying that. And so the Times asked Wallace to write an essay to explain what he meant by Americanized fascism. And that's what he produced in April of 1944. It ran in the New York Times Magazine, a very lengthy essay. And what he said was that, yes, in America, well, first off, the key thing is that he said there would be different forms of fascism around the world. You shouldn't always look for it, you know, to always mirror what you saw in Europe. And he suggested that in America, the form it might take would be corporate power, monopoly power, exploiting and extending divisions between people, trying to stir up racial divisions, trying to stir up ethnic divisions, trying to stir up class divisions, you know, so that you could end up with a politics that ultimately allowed the Wall Street folks and the corporate folks to dominate, you know, not just our economy, but really the governing of the country. And he was very careful to say that many of these folks might present themselves as patriots, that they would, you know, be at least on the surface, very supportive of the war effort. And yet, once the war was done, use the post-war era to return or extend their own power. And so what he was really doing was talking about a corporate power, a monopoly power that would be so great that it would overwhelm democracy. Not that we wouldn't have elections. We might still have elections, but that they would be so dominated by the money power, so dominated by, as he suggests, the manipulation of media, the manipulation of communications, that the will of the people would be undermined, if not actually thwarted.
Wow. I mean, it's just chillingly prescient.
No, he saw, I this is why I wrote the book. There's a lot more to talk about and why my deep concern of the Democratic Party didn't recognize this and take up this concern and make it much more central to its politics. But at the heart of it, I did want Americans in this era of Donald Trump to be thinking about the fact that we don't have to see an authoritarian threat as, you know, always wearing jackboots or always, you know, fitting into a certain form or a certain vision. It can take many, many forms. And that, you know, in the heart of World War II, the Vice President of the United States looked to the future and suggested that you could indeed end up in a situation where media, money, power combined to really create a political reality and a governing reality that was antithetical to American democracy and antithetical to the freedoms that we say we value.
Yes, and the unraveling of the New Deal and the unraveling of this vision really in the Democratic Party began way earlier than I thought. It began not with Reagan or even with Carter, but with Truman, and it did involve Henry Wallace. So, you know, I'd like to have a chance to talk a little bit more about the post-war period, but just briefly tell us, you know, what happened there? What happened in that convention in 1944?
Well, it was a pretty remarkable convention. There's no question of that. The most important thing, I think, for people to understand about the 1944 convention is that it was a wartime event. In doing the research for the book, I read through, obviously, a lot of histories, but I also looked at the newspapers from the time. And, you know, literally, as the Democratic National Convention was playing out in 1944, the events in Europe and in Asia, around the world, with the war were just jaw-dropping. I mean, it's every day, you know, wars that would define the future of the planet, or battles that would define the future of the planet, troop movements, attempted, you know, assassination of Hitler, you know, all these things playing out around this time. It was an epic moment. And so I put that up front only because people do need to understand kind of the pressures that were on this convention. And then there was an additional pressure. Roosevelt was running for a fourth term, and that had never happened before. There were people who were very concerned about, you know, when, you know, how many terms is Roosevelt going to go for? And so the Democrats were concerned. They were concerned about winning and maintaining their power. Roosevelt himself was concerned. And as part of that concern, he indicated that he was going to let the convention decide who the vice president would be. He put out a very clear statement. He said, if I was a delegate to this convention, I would vote for Henry Wallace. But he did indicate to the party bosses and the party insiders, who really dominated much more so than even than they do today, that the convention itself would decide the vice presidency. And that put Wallace in a very difficult position. He had to fight to keep his job. And he was not a classic traditional politician, so he didn't do it in the way that you would expect. He didn't do a lot of organizing and campaigning. He basically spent time taking up what at that time, I guess you could even say, were radical issues and positions, advocating for civil rights, advocating for women's rights, advocating against anti-Semitism, advocating with deep concern about class divisions in the country, talking about the need for trade unions and farms, you know, small farms. And, you know, he did all this without doing the, you know, kind of core grassroots organizing, because that wasn't where he came from politically. And so he staked his future on a speech to the convention. The bosses would not allow him to address the convention in a major address. So you understand that this is the sitting vice president of the United States, but he was not allowed to do a major speech to the convention. The only thing they allowed him to do was second the nomination of Franklin Roosevelt for a fourth term. And that's the same position, by the way, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was at the recent convention. She was seconding Bernie Sanders' nomination. And they gave, just as they did to AOC, they gave Henry Wallace a very short amount of time. But he got up at that convention and gave one of the most remarkable speeches in American political history. Instead of apologizing or, you know, being cautious, he flat out ripped into racism and segregation and said, you know, the Democratic Party has to be a liberal, a progressive party. It has to fight for the end to the poll taxes and segregation and you know, all of the divisions in this country. And it has to go forward with a vision for the post-war era that is indeed progressive. And interestingly enough, it electrified the convention. People on the floor of that convention, not all of them, obviously the segregationists and some of the, you know, the very corporate types didn't like it, but there was an electric moment. The hall was filled with cheering. The balconies were, you know, like shaking with support. And when it came time on that night to confirm Roosevelt's nomination, there was a call to renominate the full ticket to keep both Roosevelt and Wallace. And it became so intense that Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, who was a big Wallace backer, began to work his way to the stage. He knew that if he could get to the microphone at the convention in Chicago and call for a unanimous vote or for a united vote to renominate the ticket, that it would happen, that the ticket would be renominated. And so he got onto the steps to go to the podium. He was allowed there by trade unionists who were very supportive of Wallace, who were supposed to be maintaining the access to the steps. He worked his way up, literally fighting his way up the steps. There were stooges of the bosses trying to prevent him to get to the mic, from getting to the microphone. He got within a handful of feet, and the boss of the Pittsburgh Democrats, you know, shouted to shut the convention down. The chairman of the convention said he couldn't do it because the crowd was so overwhelmingly enthusiastic about renominating Wallace. But the Pittsburgh boss kept yelling, shut it down. And finally, the chair, feeling that pressure, said, you know, I hear a motion to adjourn. The hall shouted boos and shouted no. It was overwhelming. People did not want to adjourn. But the chair said, I hear a majority for adjournment, banged the gavel, and shut the convention down at 10:55 on that night. The hall was cleared. The music shut down. The lights turned off. And overnight, the bosses went into full gear. They printed different tickets so that people who had been in the convention hall the day before couldn't get in. They went, you know, delegation by delegation, offering jobs and political positions and political support. There was charges that money itself exchanged hands. And when the convention reconvened the next day, it was a very different circumstance. They did have a roll call vote for vice president. And in the first ballot, Wallace still won. He still prevailed. But the bosses then, you know, ramped it up even more. And on the ensuing ballots, Wallace's total fell, and Harry Truman, the favorite of the bosses, particularly of the big city bosses, and particularly the folks out of Missouri, St. Louis, and Kansas City, was nominated for vice president.
Wow, you know, it just makes it so clear that, you know, the history of the world can turn on a dime.
Yeah, that's what I say in the chapter. I talk about the minute on which the Democratic Party's future was decided. It came down to 10:55.
This gets to the heart of a very big question, which is the U.S. was a capitalist country. There was a tremendous amount of power that was vested in the ruling class. You know, no question about it. You had a much bigger labor movement than you have now. I mean, the labor movement was key to the New Deal. Do you think that, I mean, it's hard to play this kind of history, but I guess I'm asking a question about the relative power of, you know, of on the one hand, what we call the ruling class, and it still exists today, and the people's power that was, you know, created in this party and through labor unions and in the New Deal coalition. Is it possible for that people's movement to win when there is so much power invested in an oligopoly like what we have? This is Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with John Nichols about his new book, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party.
Yes, it is possible, and it has won at times. And it's usually with a broad coalition that sometimes involves, you know, people working with folks that they don't always agree with on everything. But I don't think there's any question that in the 1930s and early 1940s, especially, frankly, in the early 1940s, it's a much underestimated period in our history where you really did see something akin to social democracy taking form in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, in New York City itself, but also influencing the national politics. So I don't think that we should allow ourselves to fail to believe in the possibility. But I say that all to counsel that we have to be realistic. We have to understand what we're up against. And that's why my book doesn't end with Wallace. It begins with Wallace and tells all the stories that we've been telling here. But then it comes right up to the current era. And the argument I make is that there has been, frankly, an 80-year-long fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. And that at almost every turn, when progressive forces have, you know, sometimes succeeded in that fight and other times come close, they've been thwarted by political power and economic power in combination, and that in doing so, the Democratic Party has not done enough again and again and again to advance economic and social and racial justice and peace. And in those failures have created a void in our politics, you know, where people become increasingly frustrated, increasingly dissatisfied, and that void has been exploited by the right. And so my core argument is that to create a politics that gets to some of the things you're talking about, you know, a people's politics, the Democratic Party has to change. And it has to change for two reasons. Number one, because it is morally right. It is right to advance the cause of economic and social and racial justice. That is what we need, a political party in this country that does that. But also it is practically, politically correct, because when the Democratic Party fails to, you know, push as hard as it should, it stumbles, and it stumbles again and again. Truman became president in 1945 with Roosevelt's death, but in 1946, because he was insufficiently committed to a big, bold jobs program and housing programs and other programs that were necessary in the moment, the Republicans effectively got enough power in Congress to thwart Truman's initiatives. They actually passed the Taft-Hartley Law, which undermined the trade union movement. It's Republicans in combination with Southern segregationists in the Democratic Party. But that wasn't the only time that happened. In 1976, Jimmy Carter came to office after Watergate with very solid majorities in the House and Senate, but did not govern boldly. In 1978, he lost a lot of his governing authority in the Congress in the midterm elections and lost the presidency in 1980. Bill Clinton came to power in 1992 with very strong Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. He did NAFTA. He did a host of other things that basically let down huge parts of his coalition, really depressed a lot of progressives, and ended up in 1994 losing his governing majority and effectively governing in ways through the remainder of his administration that often undermined and literally took apart New Deal programs. And in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected with an epic coalition and tremendous potential, he was undermined, not just by Republicans who thwarted him in Congress, but also by centrist Democrats who kept arguing for compromise and kept arguing for doing less. And you ended up in a situation where in 2010, once again, Obama lost his governing majority and was forced during the remainder of his presidency. And I do think that Obama is a dramatically more progressive figure than Clinton, by the way. There are many criticisms of Obama, but he really was undermined severely in the remainder of his presidency. So now we have this question. It's, you know, 2020. We have a presidential election. That election is against Donald Trump. It, I would argue, needs to be won because Donald Trump is such an absolutely destructive and dangerous force. But the question is, how will Democrats govern if they do get power? What if they win the presidency, vice presidency, and also flip the Senate and have control of the House? This is a real possibility. And how will they govern in 2021? Will they govern boldly with a sufficient commitment to do the things that need to be done to address COVID-19, mass unemployment, racial injustice that has been so brought to the forefront by recent police shootings and violence, a climate crisis that is overwhelming with a very, very short timeline on what we can do, and frankly, always the great challenge of peace and the great challenge of our international relations? Will they govern insufficiently? Because if they govern insufficiently, then the Republicans will come back in 2022 and 2024, and we will have a Republican Party, I would argue, that would come back as something more dangerous even than Donald Trump. And so this is why the book is a history, but it's also, I think, an urgent argument about the moment in which we find ourselves.
Yes, and I think it's interesting that Henry Wallace, when he was thwarted with the vice presidency, went to, you know, did a third party bid for a president that was a disaster. And there are many on the left now who are just saying, who are giving up on the Democratic Party. What do you feel? I mean, as you say, Donald Trump must be defeated. How do you feel that progressives can influence the Democratic Party, which, after all, now has the presidential candidate Joe Biden is, you know, some people call him Republican light. He is very much in the center right of the Democratic Party. Kamala Harris, it's unclear how progressive she is. What do you see in terms of the forces that are available to push the top of the ticket to the left should they win?
Look, we're at a point now in our politics where clearly the Democratic Party is in transition. There is a change going on. We see it in the primary results across the country. And it's a fascinating, from a political standpoint, just a fascinating thing to watch. You know, we thought 2018 was a year in which, you know, there was a lot of turbulence, a lot of change in the Democratic Party. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez defeating the fourth-ranked Democrat in the U.S. House, Ayanna Pressley defeating a long-term member of the Democratic caucus in the House, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib winning key primaries, and other folks rising up across the country. It just seemed that, you know, yeah, 2018 was a big deal. Well, 2020 seemed far more transition in this regard, and you know, more incumbents defeated, more progressives prevail. And again, Bernie Sanders did not get nominated for president, but he certainly, you know, built out in many ways his movement, and there's a movement that he began to initiate. And so we find ourselves at a point now where Joe Biden is running for president of the United States with, it's kind of a hybrid. He is who he has always been, a very centrist and very cautious Democrat, but he does have pressure now on him to run and govern in a much more progressive way. And he's moved on some issues, particularly some of the climate issues. He's saying some better things, but it's always whipsawed. It's always kind of back and forth. And so, you know, you'll hear Biden send some pretty progressive signals, and then he'll give a speech in which he'll say, you know what, hey, I'm no radical. And so I think that the best way to understand Biden is in many ways the way that we understand Roosevelt in the early years of his presidency. Franklin Roosevelt was a more progressive figure in his time than Biden is today. But Franklin Roosevelt was not, you know, he didn't come to the presidency as the man he was when he left the presidency. And what I mean by that is that in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt ran a more progressive campaign than Herbert Hoover, but it was still a campaign that had many cautious signals and cautious messages. When he got to power, however, it became clear to Roosevelt that A, the Depression was such an overwhelming reality that he had to respond in bigger and bolder ways, and B, that if he didn't respond in bigger and bolder ways, there was a left that would become increasingly powerful and that it would, in fact, become a challenge for him. And so he did move to the left. There's no doubt of that. And so one would think that there is at least the possibility that Biden will find himself in the same circumstance. And what I mean by that is the challenges are, to my mind, of a depression level. We have a pandemic that is overwhelming. We have mass unemployment. We have fundamental issues in policing and systemic racism, in climate crisis, in so many other areas, in the basic inequalities of our society that have to be addressed. That's an overwhelming set of issues coming at him. Small steps will not be sufficient. So when you start to talk about doing what is necessary in such a moment, Biden will face the pressure of history, and that's a big deal. And then frankly, also, there is a left. It's a stronger left. It has more of an ability to put pressure on the party and on a president. And I think that many of these folks who've been elected, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and like Cori Bush, who just won her primary in Missouri, are really willing to push much harder than we saw in the past, or at least in the recent past. So I do think there's a lot of space here for progressives to influence this administration. If I was to divide it up, though, I would tell you that even with the changes that have gone on in the party, there's going to be resistance, And there's going to be a debate, and the deficit hawks will resurface, and they will say, oh, well, we can't do as much, we can't go as big, we can't respond to the pain in sufficient ways. And that's going to be a real battle. I would be lying to you if I didn't tell you that I think that's going to be a fight for the soul of, if Biden's elected, a fight for the soul of the Biden administration.
Well, luckily, we have Stephanie Kelton and modern monetary theory to finally fight back on the whole idea that deficits are something that are a problem for the federal government. This is just such a terrific book, John Nichols, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. I urge all my listeners to read it. And thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's such an honor to be with you. And again, I really appreciate what you do with this show.
John Nichols, author and political writer at The Nation magazine. Now let's turn to a fascinating look at one particular campaign and what it can tell us about how to mobilize the Latino vote. Chuck Rocha was a chief strategist for Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. While he worked broadly in the campaign, his special mission was to mobilize the Latino vote for the senator. And boy, did he succeed. Bernie basically won in Iowa with Latino support, and he crushed it in Nevada with the same. The Latino vote boosted Bernie's win in California and came out heavily for Bernie in Texas. But by the Texas primary, all the other Democratic candidates had folded in favor of Joe Biden, and Bernie's campaign collapsed. In his book, T.O. Bernie, Chuck Rocha gives us the play-by-play of how the campaign won the Latino vote. He also tells us how a working-class Latino kid from East Texas rose to become one of the most important Latino political strategists in the nation. Chuck Rocha is president of Solidarity Strategies and a co-founder of Nuestro PAC. Chuck Rocha, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this was a hugely enjoyable book to read, T.O. Bernie, The Inside Story of How Bernie Sanders Brought Latinos to the Political Revolution. It's a chronicle of the Latino voter outreach program that you helped run during Senator Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign, but it's also a lot more. It's a memoir of how you got to this point and also a deep dive into the Latino electorate. I'd like to focus on the last, just to begin with, because there's a prevalent notion, and you talk about it in the book, that Latinos don't vote. So tell us, what is the reality?
Gosh, it's just a great question. Like, Latinos don't vote, and I don't like to even say that, because I prove in this book how we do vote, if you will invest, is because nobody ever asked them. We always ask a small little group of Latinos who always vote in every election, and we never really expand that target list. The premise of the book around the Latino strategy is that if you spend as much time and effort and strategy that you do trying to persuade a white voter in the suburbs, who we will spend hundreds of millions of dollars communicating several issues over several platforms, if we did the same operation to Latinos, they would outperform white turnout and white percentages towards Democrats if the same money was spent.
Why do you say they would outperform?
Oh, because it's just a simple fact. Think about that they already vote at 65% for a Democrat, and that they turn out at whatever X percentage they turn out that year with such little investment. So I prove in the book that if you do the investment, they will turn out at great rates and vote for you in huge percentages. They just need to be asked and talked to.
You write that what set you apart and the Bernie Sanders campaign apart is that you didn't follow the same textbook that you were, quote, supposed to follow, unquote. So more than just reaching out to people, what was different?
Having a Latino at the decision-making table, where we never got left out of the equation. And so because I was a senior advisor for the Hope campaign, I outlined that impact on the overall campaign, from hiring the staff to picking out the office to putting people in positions of power to being in the room when the decision was made of where we spend this money and making sure that the Latino budget was never cut and that we actually treated Latino voters like we did white primary voters to prove a point. And because Latinos liked Bernie Sanders, and we knew they liked Bernie Sanders from the last campaign, and we had spent, much like other campaigns, very little money talking to them. So I wanted to start where we left off.
So Latinos is a very broad term. I wonder if you could break it down a little bit, because aren't there different demographics within the Latino vote itself?
Oh, that's just such a great question, because it's just the bedrock of cultural competency when it comes to Latinos. Latinos are probably the most diverse demographic in the United States because we come from so many different places, and with everybody, especially political campaigns, like to throw us into this Latino bucket. If you're from Cuba, if you're from Puerto Rico, if you're from El Salvador, if you're from Mexico. Now, keep in mind, who is the Latino community just based off the raw numbers? Almost 70% of every Latino in America is Mexican. That's, and could have been here one generation, newly arrived immigrants, or multi-generations like me. Cubans have their own unique story of leaving forced to leave an island, being exiled, special citizenship for anybody who comes to this country. Then there's the Puerto Ricans, who a big migration happened years and years ago. And then recently, many Puerto Ricans being forced off of the island because of hurricanes or economic downturns. El Salvadorians and Central Americans who've been trying to escape horrific local governments and gangs in their countries. All of that just shows that there could not be more cultural differences between all these different sectors of this beautiful fabric that we call the Latino vote or the Latino community. And to be honest, there's many in the Latino community who don't even like to be called Latino. They'd rather be called Hispanic or something else.
So this is becoming very important right now. I mean, aside from your book, you've also been talking on the airwaves about the current, campaign, Biden's campaign. And I've heard you and Bernie Sanders also have said that Biden has not reached out sufficiently to Latino voters. Given this understanding of the different demographics, talk about what needs to be done now in general, and then in specific in Florida, such a key state.
Well, the different demographics don't really make up for the singular thing that needs to happen more. And you can do this across all demographics, which is spend money to go have a conversation with these people. These people, all the different sectors of the Latino community, all want one thing. They want to know what Joe Biden is going to do to make their life better. And he is doing a decent job at that. And he will actually spend more money than Hillary Clinton did to win the same vote. And the reason that he's underperforming is because Latinos don't know him like they knew Hillary Clinton / Bill Clinton, who had been president for 8 years, and they really did like. So what you have is somebody who needs to introduce himself and let Latinos know what he stands for. In Latino focus groups, we have found that Latinos love his message and love his plan. He just needs to spend more money to get out there and tell them what that is. And besides the fact of his campaign needing to do that, he started a little bit late compared to Donald Trump because of this pandemic. And so Donald Trump got to identify who he was and kind of draw a picture that was negative of Joe Biden before Joe Biden started doing that same type of advertising. You couple that with an outside independent expenditure game. These are all the organizations that go out and run ads on behalf of Joe Biden separate from the campaign. Currently, as of 7/31, the 31st of July, I have tracked over $500 million flowing to super PACs and independent expenditure groups that are all focused on targeting the white voter and persuading them to vote for Joe Biden. In return, and in contrast, the three leading Latino super PACs and outside organizations have only been given $5 million. That's a disparity between $500 million for white voters to just $5 million for Latino voters, yet we're expected to show up at the same rate, but we don't get the same information.
So let's go back to your book, Tio Bernie and the Bernie Campaign. You mentioned before having a Latino in senior leadership of the campaign. In general, Bernie had the most diverse leadership of any presidential campaign in history. Talk a little bit about that, how the diversity was deep and wide in the organization.
I think that it's because it was a couple of reasons. One is I and a small group of people were in charge of the hiring. So we were very intentional about the way we were doing the hiring. So we wanted to make sure that we built out a diverse reflection of what Bernie Sanders wanted, which was this diverse new coalition of people. And because Bernie Sanders, like it or not, is a 78-year-old white guy from Vermont. And if you're going to have a white man be the candidate, then you need to make sure in a Democratic primary that you have a diverse senior staff and diverse staff to show your commitment to people of color, since you're not a person of color yourself, asking for the person of color vote. So, you know, we hired the first Muslim American campaign manager. All of our departments were majority women and women of color. And then the staff was majority people of color overall. So we just wanted to make sure that we wore those values on our sleeve to reflect exactly what Bernie Sanders' vision was for what his administration would look like, because the proof was in the pudding. We're showing you during the campaign exactly how we would have built out an administration.
And one of the things I found interesting is that you write that it's not broadly known that the Latino vote was not only a key part of the 2018 blue wave that took back the House, so that's on the one hand, but also served as a critical pillar of Bernie Sanders' thinking as he came to decide on whether he would run in 2020. So tell us about both parts of that sentence.
First is the 2018 scenario where Latinos were super motivated to show up and vote in an off-year election. And for those of you students at home, an off-year means a year when the president is not on the top of the ballot, ginning up support for big turnout. So in off-year elections, every other presidential year, off year, less people show up, almost 40% less overall. Well, this time in 18, after the first election of Donald Trump, we saw a huge uptick in all voters' participation, but a huge uptick in Latino turnout. A lot of that had to do with Donald Trump's attack on Latinos, rhetoric about the border wall, and about him starting his own campaign by demagoguing Latinos. So there was this anxiety and frustration that Latinos acted out by showing up. So Donald Trump was our best GOTV, our best get out the vote operation director, and he didn't even know it. And because we had so many great Latino candidates in places like Miami with Debbie Mercosol Powell, Sochi Torres Small in New Mexico, Gil Cisneros in California, the DCCC for the first time in its history actually hired a bunch of Latino staff and consultants to actually work on turning up the Latino vote. And again, you'll see this common thread. When you spend money to go talk to Latinos, they will show up, exactly how I talked about T.O. Bernie. Now, talking about Bernie's 2015 and 16 performance that led to him deciding whether he would run or not, is we ended the 16 campaign knowing that he was hugely popular with a demographic that we had really not spent that much time and energy courting. So a big part of him deciding to run is knowing that he had this base of support. Him bringing me in to kind of run the whole operation with Jeff Weaver and a small team of people to actually start and build off of the Latino vote being a bedrock of support that he would need in a multi-candidate primary to actually be able to take out a lot of other campaigns that would be a lot well-financed and a lot more tied into the establishment arm of the party.
You also talk about how Bernie's thinking on immigration evolved. You know, you say he's very popular. I'd like to know why you think Bernie is so popular with the Latino community. And is part of that his thinking on immigration, and who helped him evolve on that?
One is he's popular because he spent the money to go tell people who he is. And when we spent that money to go tell people, the first ad we ran, the first mail piece we sent to Latinos said, Bernie Sanders' father immigrated here from another country. And he couldn't speak English and he had no money, but he was able to attain the American dream. And when Bernie Sanders is in the presidency, he won't forget what it's like to be in that immigrant family for the rest of us immigrants. Mm-hmm. So that let people know that he was one of them, even though he was this white guy who talked funny, that he had lived the immigrant experience and that his father had the same story as many Latino fathers and grandmothers, that they came here and they couldn't speak the language and had no money. Bernie Sanders lived in that household. And so it made a commonality. You couple that with issues that Latinos just align with, like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, raising the minimum wage. And then they trusted him because they considered him one of them as the son of an immigrant. And then his issue set overwhelmingly overlapped with working class Americans, which guess what? Is most Latinos. And when it goes to immigration as a whole, he surrounded himself with Latino staffers who helped actually write the policy. He had eight dreamers on his national staff who helped put together the policy that was the most progressive immigration policy in the history of campaigns. And what you get there is the perfect storm.
It was actually kind of the perfect win in Nevada. You say in your book, Chuck Rocha, NTO Bernie, that Nevada was everything. So just if you can briefly tell us, how did you win so big in Nevada?
Starting early is one. So our first piece of communication went to Latinos in Nevada 7 months before the caucus. Second, we set up our offices in the community. So the very first office we opened was in East Las Vegas in the heart of the Latino community. And that was a sign to the community, Bernie Sanders is here. He's here first. And he set up his offices in the heart of our community. The third thing we did is we hired a lot of Latinos from that community. We had over 100 Latinos on staff. And then the last and most important piece is we spent $2 million on a multi-layered paid communication that included mail, TV, radio, digital, Pandora, in almost every way Latinos consume information in that state. But we didn't start the last 2 weeks like most campaigns. We started 7 months out and never stopped. We talked to the average Latino caucus goer in Nevada 22 times before Election Day.
I remember when you said before the Texas primary that you thought that we could actually have a win in Texas. So Bernie didn't win in Texas. Talk about why not. Then why you still think Texas can turn blue?
So we won the Latino vote in Texas, and I knew we were going to win the Latino vote in Texas big because I had spent a lot of time and money making sure that we were the only campaign really down there talking to Latinos. So we had that in our back pocket. Now, what I didn't know is right before the election would happen in Texas, the field would consolidate down and everybody else would get out of the race. And so what that meant is we lost white voters on election day in dramatic form compared to what the polling had showed us early on. And I couldn't make up with that because there's more white people voting in the primary than Latinos, even though we overwhelmingly won the Latino vote. Because of the consolidation of the field, we lost white working class voters who were voting for Pete and for Warren and other candidates who all voted for Joe Biden on that day, which was the only reason, or we would have done exactly what I said we did because the vote was what we thought, but it needed to be spread out over four or five different candidates. So it's just a mathematical game.
So what do you make of that consolidation? I mean, I wonder if you could say a little bit about the DNC's, you know, hostility to Bernie Sanders and how that whole thing just, you know, after South Carolina and Super Tuesday, it just all went down the way it did.
I'm sure you were shocked when you read the book and saw the truths that I could have exposed in this book of what people in the public didn't know, which is all the polling that I had leading into Super Tuesday. And that I will tell you, and you need to get the book and read T.O. Bernie, and you'll see that I had polling in my hands from our pollster in-house, where Bernie Sanders was winning every Super Tuesday state after Nevada by at least 3 points. Even states like North Carolina and Florida, we were winning Florida by 2 points, to be honest. And that's because Michael Bloomberg was in the race. There was four or five other credible candidates in the race. Everybody was splitting the vote. And Bernie Sanders was getting a rock solid 25% in every one of those, while Joe Biden and Bloomberg were locked anywhere between 19 and 22 in every one of the states, including Texas. And so if I had that polling, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'm a senior strategist, that meant that the other senior strategist and the other campaigns who could afford polling had the exact same damn polling that I had that showed Bernie Sanders was fixing to be the damn nominee. And he was going to be the nominee because we just won Nevada. We'd really won Iowa and New Hampshire. And we were fixing a sweet Super Tuesday. And the race was going to be over. Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee. This was prior to South Carolina. But, you know, it was almost, and I can't prove that the DNC did this. And I'm not even going to say that they were part of it. All I know that is that everybody got out of the race all at the same time and consolidated behind Joe Biden. And that was the end of us because it just totally messed up our Super Tuesday. And it was the only chance we had to lose that.
So looking forward now, you worry that the lack of investment in the Latino turnout operation is not just going to impact the presidential campaign, but also some congressional seats that will make them hard for Democrats to hold. So I wonder if you could talk about some of those seats. And then is there anything that those of us who want to see a progressive agenda continue and fascism be destroyed in this country, is there anything that we can do between now and the election to help?
I think just always having validators, whether they're white validators, progressive validators, talking about the importance of the Latino vote. But more, we've been doing the importance of the Latino vote for several cycles now because people have understood. But we should all be talking about the lack of investment, sister. And what I get out here is because my values are Bernie Sanders' values, and I'm a progressive at heart because I grew up so poor in East Texas, like you see in the book. Because that's why I told that story, so people would know where I look at through the lens of politics, of not having any money, not going to college, being a former felon, like all the things that make me just a regular American. I think that that's important in political consulting. And so I think that if we were to have a real investment in Latino youth and explaining to them why the minimum wage should be $15 and why Democrats should be real Democrats and not just Republicans in Democratic clothing, you would create a progressive movement that couldn't be stopped. You would have armies of AOCs because these Latinos want to align with Bernie Sanders' top issues. And we just need to invite more of them into the party.
Well, the book is really a great read and also taught me a whole lot about political campaigns about which I was completely ignorant.
That's an honor. You just give me a great compliment. Thank you.
So the book is T.O. Bernie. Thank you so much, Chuck Rocha, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
My pleasure.
Chuck Rocha. Chuck Rocha's book is T.O. Bernie. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.